Good afternoon and welcome to the Institute of Politics Forum. My name is John Palfrey of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. It's a great honor for us to be kicking off our 10th anniversary celebration of the Berkman Center here at the IOP Forum, and to have a great panel of experts and all of you here, experts in the audience as well, to talk about an issue that we think is core to the future of our republic, which is whether or not youth are getting more involved in civic life. The 2008 campaign is the focus of our conversation, but we'll broaden it out beyond that, of course, to an international scope. And we want to ask hard questions, especially about whether or not the role of technology is something that's relevant here, and whether we're at a moment of inflection, whether it's a watershed, or whether this is a blip. The mode here is very conversational. I'll be asking a few questions of the panel, and then we will go to questions from the group and discussion, hopefully about a half hour in. We'll go roughly till 7. Just so everyone knows, this is being webcast live and recorded for posterity. And when we turn to questions, we ask that you identify yourself and speak for the record. Also, that you make your comments brief and end with a question mark. We very much do encourage you to participate. So the backdrop of this conversation is thinking about a trajectory and trying to figure out whether we're headed in the right direction or in the wrong direction. And if it is going the wrong way, are there interventions that we need to take in order to encourage young people in particular to get more involved in civic life? There's a raging debate in the academic world as to whether or not youth are getting more or less involved in civic life and whether or not the internet has anything to do with that. So one way of telling the story, some people who analyze polling data will say, if you look back at 1972, half of young people in America voted in primary elections, and by 2000 we'd seen a decline to about a third, and that maybe there's an uptick now, but that this is a really bad story. Some people will tell it a different way. They'll cut the data in another direction, or they'll point to the impact of the internet in the last few years to say that we're headed in the right direction. There are others who say, talking about voting is actually not really the whole story. It's about participating in different ways. And those are the kinds of issues that we want to get at tonight. So by way of introduction, I'm going to start with Ari Melber. He is the Net Movement correspondent, I dare say the first ever Net Movement correspondent for The Nation magazine, which is the oldest political weekly in the United States. He's also a columnist for Politico and for Personal Democracy Forum, a wonderful website, nonpartisan website. Ari Melber, will you start out by giving us a sense of the historical context of the 2008 election cycle and whether or not we have reason for optimism or if we think that we should be worried about where things are headed in America?
I'm very optimistic. John's right. There's this ongoing discussion when you compare it back to about 1972 and the peak of the Vietnam War and the kind of activism you had there, obviously, young people voting and the highest turnout for non-college-educated unenrolled young people that we've seen in the last century and have not gotten back up to those numbers at this point in history. So we're not quite back up there yet, but there was about a 10% spike from 2000 to 2004, largely on the Democratic side for voters under 30 and largely perceived to be a reaction to President Bush's leadership. And then this cycle, again on the Democratic side, we've seen the participation in voting in primaries for people under 30 jumped by about 90%, which is really unheard of.
So pause on that for a sec. Describe what is a 90% spike that we've seen so far mean?
What that basically means is as compared to primary turnout in 2004, we've jumped up to, I think, over about 50% for people turning out in the primaries we've been having.
Who are underage 30.
And the spike on the Republican side was about 7%. Very different dynamics for them coming off 8 years of an incumbent party. It's just a very different set of incentives. But the 90% spike is huge, and a big point I want to make to kind of kick off our conversation, no one knows, I can't say whether this is portending a multi-decade surge or anything to get us back to the type of participation we had in the 70s, but I can tell you that if you look at the first couple of state races in the Democratic contest, starting in Iowa, you basically had an unheard-of surge of the voters under 30 change the entire dynamic of this race. If only prior caucus attendees had showed up on caucus night in Iowa, John Edwards would have won Iowa. If you just envision that change, nothing else, but just that, and Edwards won Iowa and Senator Clinton won the next two states and Senator Obama only won the fourth state in the mix, South Carolina, and then on to Super Tuesday, I think it's fairly clear Barack Obama would not be the presumptive nominee, which he is today. And in Iowa, again, we saw a pattern where voters under 30 turned out at about 22% higher than the next section of voters 30 to 45, which is also unheard of. Again, let's remember, people under 30 are fairly off the grid. They're hard to reach. The political parties are not incentivized to find them and turn them out. We can talk more about how the Obama campaign broke with those traditions. But I think it is fair to say that one of the dispositive benefits of the Obama campaign was that turnout. And at the time, people said, oh, this won't redound to his benefit in other states. It did. We've seen the turnout spike in most states. And one last data point, and I promise I'll use more adjectives and less numbers
as
the night goes on. But one last data point is that in the states that we have data for, about 33 states have youth and demographic data for exit polling of this cycle. Barack Obama won the youth vote under 30 in 26 of them, including Senator Clinton's home state of New York. So this is a part of his winning coalition. Without it, he would not be the presumptive nominee that he is today.
Ari Melber, thank you for that set of data and a story to work with. So turning to you, Jesse Dillon. Jesse is someone who's been credited with some of this upsurge in young people getting involved in politics. He and his colleague here, Wes Hill, who I'll introduce in a moment, are creators of Hope Act Change. They've created a famous video, Yes We Can. Jesse, can you tell us a little about the story that got you involved in creating this video and whether you think what you've done has anything to do with the story that Ari's telling right now?
You know, I probably got to Obama later than most people. And
can you say who you're supporting?
Well, I was probably, I was more in, you know, Ron Paul, you know, probably would have been more my choice at that time. But I saw this speech. The speech was really inspirational, and it made me, it really connected me.
Tell us more about the speech.
I think the values and the hope, you know, the things that he talked about in the speech were you know, just articulated a lot of things I thought myself, and so I...
And where was he? Give it the sort of context for the speech itself.
You know, I don't even know the exact, you know, it was just, where was it at?
He gave the speech in South Carolina, just before the primary.
There. You know, and I just happened to be watching it, and, you know, a friend of mine, Will I Am, we worked together in the past, we'd both seen it and wanted to do something about it, and I think the thing about it is that he was already at that time kind of gathering support as, you know, the people who were in the video. People just wanted to be a part of it because there really was no plan to make, you know, he was behind in the polls at the time. And so the idea was, could we do something quick enough to get it out there to try and affect it? And I think that if 10,000 people had seen it, we would have considered it to be pretty successful. What happened was, you know, when we first started doing it, there were only a few people involved. And over the day, the 2 days, these were people who had actually been on the campaign with Obama and were already supporters, and they all just came in. And we made the video. And when it was finished, I think the thing is, if 10,000 people had seen it, it would have been good. But once we finished it, I remember, you know, the ticker on YouTube just started, you know, at first it was like 500 people, then it was 5,000 people, then it was... you know, 100,000 people, and just grew out of control. And I think that that's because people want a change, and when they see the video and they see how powerful his words are, I think that it just embodies what a lot of people are hopeful about. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think people really respond to in it. You know?
And you've got some pretty famous people to get involved in this, right? This wasn't just kind of a bunch of random people putting together a little video on YouTube, right?
Well, they're not as... famous. I mean, yeah, there's some in there that are pretty famous. At first, it was just Will.i.am, John Legend, and Scarlett Johansson. That was the whole video. And then what happened over the day, and what I think is nice, is that these aren't like calling up celebrities and trying to get them in it. These just happened to be people who all were coming back from the campaign, had been out there on the road, and all really felt a connection to him. So I think that it's a lot of times you see stuff like that, and it's jaded. In this case, I think that it's these people really genuinely believe the message of what they're saying, and I think that subconsciously, people want to believe things like that. So I think that that's what people, I think people do respond that there's celebrities in there, but I think the real power of it is his message, you know, what he's trying to say. You know?
That's great. Yeah. Jesse Dillon, thank you. So Wes Hill, you and I were classmates at Harvard College here, class of 94. He was the first class marshal of our class. You've turned out now to be a partner with Jesse in this Hope Back Change effort and a writer and author. Do you think there's any connection between the story of this video and its attractiveness and kind of the trajectories we're talking about? Does it connect with youth? Is that part of the story we're talking about here?
It does, John. I don't have any empirical data in terms of how many youth have viewed the video, but I think that, for me at least, the Senator Obama's speech really struck a chord with so many people because he expressed the story of our country from so many different angles, and you know whether it was the settlers, you know, moving out into the frontier, moving west, whether it was the slaves, you know, finding their freedom and making a life for themselves, saying, yes, we can, whether it was the Latinos and the Cesar Chavez movement of Si Se Puede. All of those stories are a part of America. And his words were so eloquent, and I think that if, again, I can't speak empirically, but if you sometimes hear talk about, well, youth are disenfranchised, they feel disconnected, this was a way to connect to the story of America.
So Wes, tell us how they connected. So you've gotten a fair amount of responses to this video, videos that other people have created, stories people have told you about the Yes We Can video, how that's affected their own thinking about the campaign. What's the flavor of that, and can you point to anything in the reaction you've gotten to this story about whether or not youth are more or less engaged in politics this time around?
Well, one way to think about it, I think, is to think about participation and what does that mean? Is it just voting, or is it some other way? And I think that we've seen that through this video. We've seen a lot of responses to it that have been posted on YouTube. It's really how the site Hope Act Change grew, was we had such a positive response. People sent us videos, they sent us texts, people from all over the world. And we worked with Professor Kareem Lakhani at the Harvard Business School and three of his top students, John, Luke, and Dave. We worked with a web development company in New York called Syrup. This was a complete volunteer effort. The entire site is volunteer based, and it's a collaborative effort. And I think really what it says is it's not really what our leaders do; it's what we do to affect change. And that's really the message we're trying to spread.
Wes, you've been doing that very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, may I ask you just to comment on whether or not you think there's a connection between the Yes We Can video story, how it's been created, how people have engaged with it, and this youth story that you've been telling us, and I'll turn to Jeff after that. What, if anything, is the connection between these two strands we've developed so far?
I think part of the connection is just a different, richer way to engage in politics. You know, it's funny when we talk about some of the old data or what is civic involvement or you know, Robert Putnam's work on bowling alone. For a long time, there were several metrics you would test. Do you vote? Do you vote in primaries? Do you volunteer with an organization? Do you attend meetings? Have you held a leadership position? Did you write a letter to the editor? And a couple more. But that was a fairly set window for decades. And what we have now are all of these other activities, some of which could be called entertainment, some of which could be called communicative, some of which could be called solitary, but they are a rich way of engaging in politics. And so I do think it's a big part of it. I do think we have to be careful to distinguish between entertainment and saying, look at this funny video, whether it's about politics or not, which was part of the viral chatter here that may have had no effect on turnout or other more traditional political activity, and richer activity. You mentioned that, and it's true, if you go on YouTube, you'll see all these video responses to that original video, and you see that with a lot of the political videos, and someone is uploading their video response. I'm not convinced that our empirical metrics catch that. In other words, is that a letter to the editor, or is that social networking? That's a new way of engaging the material and talking back, and a lot of it clearly primes, clearly primes the type of activism we're seeing. One metric is that if you ask people under 30 in this election cycle how they follow the campaign, about 18% say they use local news. A much higher number say they use the internet writ large, you know, any website to gather info. And about 18% say they use social networks, Facebook or MySpace, to follow the campaign. And so there may be a bit of a gateway drug quality. You start with the cool video, you end up friending Ron Paul or John McCain, and now you're getting regular updates in there. So I do think there's a step in there.
Excellent segue. Jeff Frazee is the National Youth Coordinator of the Ron Paul campaign. This is one of the other big stories, clearly, of this cycle, the extent to which the Ron Paul campaign engaged a lot of youth. I understand you're sort of winding down now to some extent with the campaign, but you've had a period during which this is a very important aspect of what happened on the Republican side. At one point, you had more cash in the bank than John McCain, right? Some of this raised online. Plainly, the Facebook organizing approach was a big piece of what you've done. To what extent do you think there are stories from the Ron Paul campaign as you've experienced it that suggests that Ari Melber's right, that there's a big spike here and we're seeing really a sea change in terms of how young people get engaged?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I wish Jesse would have contacted me and helped us make a video, because a Ron Paul video with celebrities probably would have helped us.
Like 2012, you've got your man, yeah. Right?
But no, I think the big question for what comes out of this Ron Paul movement is what's next? What is Revolution 2.0? What comes out of the campaign? Is this a movement or is this a one-time thing? And I think it's been categorized that this is not going to be a one-time thing. This is not going away. And Dr. Paul has recognized that, and his supporters have recognized that, and we're trying to do our best to plan for step two. But looking back on the campaign, now that we are kind of winding down, and how social networking was utilized, our primary platform for Students for Ron Paul was Facebook. There's a lot of limitations in Facebook, most notably, there's no mass messaging. You can't.
Right. Once you get to 1,100 users or something, you can't.
Once you get 1,000 users, 1,000 members in a group, you can no longer communicate them on a mass scale. And so that was a great barrier that we had to overcome, and Facebook still hasn't found a way to get around that. But to give you kind of a structure, what we did was, because we did start from scratch, there really was no network already in place. We didn't have consultant programmers lined up that were going to develop some mass network like the My Obama or My Barack Obama is. And so we had to use things that were already out there. And Facebook, we utilized, the way I structured it was each chapter, student group, had to start a Facebook group for their university. And I started a private group that was just for what I called the campus officers, the group leaders. And that is what enabled us to communicate directly with the group leaders, and hopefully that trickled down and was able to talk with their individual members on their campus. And then we also had a national group that had upwards of over 65,000 members that was very active, and I was willing to bet probably one of the most active Facebook groups maybe ever. That's where I log on every morning, was get my news, was what was posted on the Facebook group. What was the discussion? What was a hot topic? And so that's where we utilized, was Facebook primarily. There's a lot of, like I said, a lot of barriers and a lot of problems, limitations with Facebook. And I'm interested to see what comes out of this, whether social networks develop. I know, and I mentioned this in the email we spoke earlier, but Meetup was another social network we used beyond just Students for Ron Paul. It was kind of our national grassroots organization. And Meetup, there are many limitations with Meetup, but one thing that they are trying to overcome is a Meetup alliance. And it's the ability that these individual Meetup groups across the country can come together in some sort of cohesive structure and allow communication and some sort of networking on that level. Because a lot of problems we had was you couldn't communicate, again, on a grand scale with all these Meetup groups. They were doing different things. You could never get feedback from them. And this Meetup alliance kind of adds another layer. So it's a group with groups amongst this that makes this one group. And so I'm interested to see how well that works, the Meetup alliance. But for Students for Ron Paul and how the youth was based, a lot of it was communicating through Facebook, and then from there, getting some of the action items that we try to enact.
So, Jeff, do you subscribe to Ari Melber's gateway drug analogy, this notion
that... I think that's actually very interesting how you describe it, because it's very true. I very often, not even just amongst friends, but other people who would email me saying, and there's a famous picture, actually, from on our website that has a guy holding up a sign that says, Ron Paul cured my apathy, Dr. Paul cured my apathy. And it's so true is that we brought so many young people and so many new people into politics because he had this fresh message. And I think that is the focal point for the Ron Paul campaign, is the message. And Dr. Paul will tell you that members of Congress have come up to him and, you know, become pretty friendly now that he's able to raise this money and come to him, how do you do it? You need to train us. How do you raise this money? How do you raise this money?
And so how do you raise the money?
And it's funny, he laughs, but he's like, it's the message. Look how I vote. I mean, people donate to the cause. They're donating to my message. That's not a specific mechanism we utilized. It was having the right voting record. It was the integrity. It was the ability to talk about minimal government, talk about bringing our troops home from Iraq. It was the message, well, and that resonated.
So, all right, I'd love to hear your intervention, but also, would you mind sort of giving us the same story on the Republican side mm-hmm. as the story you've given on the Democratic side when you're talking about how important this has been to Obama? What's sort of the headline of the role of the internet and youth and technology and so forth in the McCain, Ron Paul, and so forth race?
Well, and I want to disagree respectfully because it's really to pay the campaign a larger compliment, but it's not, in my view, just the voting record. It was also a campaign that made people feel like they were part of something. It's hard to get people to give money to some faraway national candidate. This is not how most political fundraising works, where someone that you sort of know calls you and says, come on, $25 or $500, depending on your bracket, and you go along or you go to the event. This is a totally different thing. This is like you log on and you give and it's over. And so I do think it was more than just his voting record, but the way that the campaign, through creative initiatives like, you know, the money bombs, where they said, we're going to get a lot of good news coverage and really boost the campaign in a special way if we all do something together. That something, of course, was still giving money. But it was a collective bottom-up project. So I do think those processes have a lot to do with it. None of that works if people don't believe in the person and their values and their votes. But a similar voting record on someone who didn't get it or have people around him who were willing to share the spotlight, really, with their supporters, I don't think would have fared as well. The question on how the Republicans are doing, number one, just not as well. The political dynamic here, as I mentioned briefly, is one of a fatigued party in power. Even the most aggressive Republican strategists, Karl Rove included, are not predicting that they're going to win back the Congress this cycle. They are hoping to find a way to hold on to the White House and not lose too badly. Yesterday, they just lost a seat that Republicans had held by 20-point margins. So that's a very different dynamic to then ask people who are hurting in the economy and have their kids to raise and all the normal things that keep people away from daily politics to come in and give up their money and time. So I just think it's a really inhospitable environment. Having said that, you know, John McCain is someone who has been backsliding. In 2000, he used the internet. He was the first person to have a quote-unquote online fundraiser in 2000. He was the Straight Talk Express. A lot of successful internet candidates say the uncomfortable truths. They're the Howard Deans and the John McCains of their party, and people sort of mock them, and then 3 or 4 years later, what they're saying is the conventional wisdom. And I think John McCain had that quality. In my personal opinion, some of that seems to have faded. So he did better on the internet in 2000 than he did in 2004. And the last point I would make, again specific to McCain, because I think you can speak much more intelligibly about Paul, is that Obama has fared very well by engaging the entire internet. He's gone well beyond using it just for fundraising or activating the base and moved into basically a recruitment tool, which people didn't previously think was very possible on a national scale. So he's gone into places like MySpace and BlackPlanet.com that are not political websites, first and foremost, and got hundreds of thousands of people to connect with him and then started giving them information and interacting. McCain has not yet done that. He's failed to do that. If you look at TechPresident.com, you'll see his stats on the social networking pages are much lower. That's not because there aren't Republicans in the country on Facebook, right? It's something about their failure and their inability to make this their year to get active. Where he is doing better is engaging the conservative blogosphere. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama has distanced himself from that, partly because Barack Obama is a post-partisan candidate and the liberal blogosphere and the net roots are fiercely partisan. So from the get-go, he has been definitely an arm's-length relationship. That's why most of the net roots supported John Edwards and other candidates initially. McCain holds a weekly bloggers conference call. He engages these folks. He talks through his differences with them because they differ on immigration. They've differed on some economic issues. But that, I think, is an area that's been strong for him.
Great. So, Jeff, back to you for whether or not that's the right story on the Republican side, and whether Ari's being fair, both to your candidate and to Senator McCain. But then I want to ask each of you to speculate on the future, and I'll ask that question in a moment.
No, I think you're completely correct, and I think it's
disagreement is encouraged, by the way, Jeff. So,
no, yeah. I think it is. I don't think you can't slight the message either. I think the message is very important. I get that every day, people telling me it just makes sense, or I donated to him because this man, we need in the office today. But you're right, it's very much enabled by the grassroots. There's some ownership within the campaign. From the beginning, it was a decision that there was, but we never decided to make it a top-down approach. Our approach was always to kind of allow the free market of ideas, the free market of campaigning, to kind of see what rose to the top, for better or for worse. I mean, it had its drawbacks, but we had places like Ron Paul Forums and the Daily Paul, which were not connected to the campaign, that were kind of the central websites for a lot of the discussion. And for instance, the Money Bomb, what we developed and allowed us to raise $5 million on one day and $6 million on another day, which broke primary fundraising records. And that was totally a brainchild of someone in the grassroots. The campaign was no way associated. We were actually almost scared to associate with it because of the amount of money it was raised from a grassroots idea and what the FEC may come in and say and whatnot. So we kind of distanced ourselves from that and just upgraded our servers and got the website ready and made a nice, good-looking graphic that kind of, I guess, to our credit, we kind of allowed donating to be open source in a way that we put the person's name on the website when they donated and allowed a meter to increase. So you kind of saw what the instant response was to your donation. And by allowing that, the grassroots took this idea of, you know what, we're not getting coverage by the media. We need to come up with something. We need a big fundraising date. Dr. Paul needs money. So they've all rallied around November 5th as being the date that we're going to raise money. And it happens to be Guy Fawkes Day and a couple other holidays. And so that word just spread virally. People started signing up, and when the day hit, we just watched. I remember going to bed about 1:30 that morning, and we'd almost raised $1 million. And my expectation was like $1 million. Like, we'll see if we raise $1 million. I woke up the next morning, and sure enough, we'd already raised over $3 million. And this was not done by the campaign, but done entirely virally and by the grassroots, kind of catching on to this message, catching on to ownership of this campaign, and feeling a part of it, and donating. And a lot of people even commented on sitting there wasting their entire day watching the meter slowly tick up day as the day progressed.
It's the kind of wasting you like to see.
Right, exactly. And right. We did the same. So
one last question, then I want to open it up for conversation more broadly. But I see our founder, Charles Nesson, over here, founder of the Berkman Center. Charlie Nesson, wonderful professor. And one of the things that Professor Nesson encourages us to do as his students and as his colleagues is to focus on the rhetoric, focus on the narrative. What's the story here that kind of explains this, what makes it real? I think if we think about internet and politics and young people over the course of the last several cycles, the way we could tell that story is in 2000, John McCain is doing some of the most basic stuff. You've got a website up, you do some fundraising on there. That's kind of the first seeds of something happening in this environment. In 2004 with eBay and others, we did a study of internet and politics at that point, and clearly you had the Dean campaign, you had much more of the fundraising story, but you also the blogosphere become a force, right? It's interesting that it took a long time for the blogosphere to come up in this conversation this time. In 2008, maybe you guys are the story, right? To some extent, it's, you know, what is the power of an outside group doing a video of the sort that you guys had that really lit up the campaign at a certain key moment? Maybe it's the Ron Paul outsider story, getting people galvanized. What's the story going to be like in 2012? What should we be heading toward? And in some ways, what should we be building toward? I think, you know, one of the stories I've heard you tell, Jesse, is you got engaged in this because you want to do something good, right? This is kind of an old fashioned, you want to get involved in making the world a better place. What's the story we're heading toward in 2012, and what's the thing that we should each do as sort of an intervention to make that happen?
Well, I don't know what we should each do, but what I would say is just that if it tells you anything, it's that a few individuals now have the opportunity to affect things in a big way, because it's not like you have any distribution barriers to being able to do something. It was, you know, in the end, it's two or three people got together, made that video, and you know, I think over 30 million people have seen it now, and there's no cost for distribution. So, you know, I think this idea, you know, this is a variant, these are variations on the idea that you don't need any, it doesn't take money to reach the people that you want to speak to. And I think that it's good for people who are independent to be able to, you know, make their own, have their own feelings about what they want to say and be able to do it easily. I think that's the message.
Is it real or is it a myth that young people are going to be more likely to take advantage of this medium? Should we think about this as a youth story, or is that a red herring?
I think that's a bit of a red herring, because I think that people take advantage of it who actually use these tools, and young people use the tools, so they're able to get into this slipstream of it quicker than other people. But I don't think it's a particularly, and I think that you were saying that statistically young people have voted in this huge amount, and I think that probably has more to do with the country really needs a change right now. So I think that people are naturally getting out to try and change it, because things have to change.
So Wes Hill, I've heard you describe this as not just a story about individual autonomy, the ability of an individual to do something, but also sort of a collective story, as in, you know, what we can each do together when kind of connected through the net. Is that the narrative going forward, or do you have a different story for 2012?
Well, I think that at least for Hope Act Change, that's the narrative we're working towards, and that's how it began, and that's how it's grown. After the video spread, we started building the site, and then we asked those who had joined early on, what sort of site would you like to see? And so it's being driven by those responses. You know, so somebody said, well, the video was very inspiring to me. How about an inspiration of the week? So we put that up there. And now there's call for an action of the week, so that we actually, if you can take people who are inspired, and then actually, well, let's actually act on that, and let's see if we can affect positive change.
It's also not connected with the campaign in any way.
Mm-hmm. No.
And it doesn't raise any money. It's just a place for people to express themselves. You know, there's no financial incentive to join Hope Act Change, you know?
And one last thing while you guys are on the spot. So one of the key things clearly about this cycle is video has taken on a more important, aspect here. Something, again, Charles Nestin's been saying for years and years, it's all going to be about video, right? Is there something beyond video, or are we just, like, scratching the surface? In 2012, it's going to be, all about video over broadband.
I think to say it's about video it's about telling stories. Mm-hmm. It's easier for a lot of people to watch a video than it is necessarily to read a long thing. But I think that people like Jonathan Harris and thewhalehunt.org are telling stories in new and different ways. And it's like, I think that, the web is an opportunity to tell stories in a nonlinear way where it isn't really going to be about a video per se, just in a straight line. It can be all sorts of different things. I think
that's
by the time we get around to this next time, there'll be all different ways of telling short form content that has a camera, but the camera's not necessarily the most important thing,
So Jeff, if you were right now advising the candidates who are thinking about 2012, just speculating out, what are the key lessons that you've learned in this campaign that kind of help tell what you think the narrative will be?
I think listening to the grassroots, listening to the ideas that come out of that. I think a lot of the great ideas that came out of this entire campaign, whether it was your video or the money bombs or the Obama girl, all this stuff, they weren't ideas or decisions made by the campaign. They were decisions by some individual out there who had some creative idea, and it rose to the top. And that's kind of, I think, the narrative for what this technology is, and not only politics, but on a broader scale, is that it lowers barriers to entry, it increases distribution, so people who have ideas can put them out there and see if they catch on and grow virally. And so that's what I would say if I was paid, consultant, or asked to consult a future campaign, it would be to, see what's out there, listen to people, open up your campaign, have your site be a little bit more open source, allow people to kind of interact with your website and have some sort of ownership of your campaign. And that was the biggest lesson I have learned, and for better, we did a decent job, but I think there was weaknesses as well where we could have done better. And moving forward, I think that it will just be greater in the future.
Great. So I want to encourage people to start going to microphones who'd like to have a comment. But Ari Melber, I want to give you the last word for the panel. Help us imagine this narrative going toward 2012. You've been immersed in the data and the kind of story. Do you think we're going to see a continued uptick in youth involvement in political activity and or other aspects of kind of democratic life going forward?
I think the narrative is the counterculture is the culture. And we have been habituated for decades to have people who know tell us about politics and tell us how to evaluate politicians and what decisions matter and what are issues and what are not issues and what are political vulnerabilities. And it turns out that a lot of these people are woefully wrong. They're not just wrong in the sense that they look at the issues the wrong way. Electability and strategy should not guide our democracy, and I think most people agree on that if they talk about it and think about it. But moreover, they've really been wrong on their own terms. Their predictions about those very narrow subsets of political insider BS are often wrong. So they were wrong to tell us that Senator Clinton was inevitable. They were wrong to tell us that John McCain should be counted out. They were wrong to tell us that Ron Paul was, quote, fringe, which was a very common term applied to him by journalists. Whatever else you want to say, it wasn't fringe in the sense of the political spectrum, as evidenced by the great outpouring of support for him. It turned out, if by fringe we mean political support or voters, that Rudy Giuliani was fringe in the Republican Party, not Dr. Paul. So when you have people in the media in a position of power and authority be that wrong for that long on their own narrow terms, I'm not even going to step outside of our scope and talk about Iraq or constitutional rights or all these other important ways that people feel the media has failed, then you get, I think, a real environment, a receptivity to counter-narratives, to counter-culture. And with the platforms that we now have set up, it's game on. So, you know, when you look at, like, the brouhaha over the ABC debate, where Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos spent the first 45 minutes talking about superficial items and not the issues, it wasn't, you know, political activists or hardcore Obama supporters on the internet coordinating something in a top-down way. It was people across the country feeling at some innate level that they could strike back. And the comments poured in overnight on the ABC website and other places. And the next day, you had the news organization ABC on the defensive, granting interviews, which they're loath to do, to explain their journalistic process, because they were under pressure, not from operatives, but from the people. So I do think that you can get that immediate pushback in the same news cycle, whether it's fierce, like the example of the ABC debate, or it's lighthearted, like what we see on The Daily Show, where millions more people get a sense of the cable news and some of its vapidity through Jon Stewart than they would from watching cable news, because Jon Stewart has much higher ratings than Chris Matthews. So that counterculture narrative about how silly cable news is or how bad it is for meaningful democracy is hitting people of all ages, you know, faster, quicker, and, you know, with a wider scope than the original content, than the original culture. I didn't answer your second question, but maybe
great.
Later.
That's great. So game on. Please come to the mic. And again, the rules are please identify yourself first off, and one question per customer, and please end it with a question mark as well. Yes, please.
Hi, Diane Tucker's my name. I'm wondering whether there's actually anything to be learned from the Mike Huckabee experience. I don't know whether it's more of the same, or it seemed to me, and again, my knowledge of this isn't deep, but that actually the bulk of his work came from young people who were outside his campaign, and they managed to actually sort of pull into greater power, I mean, a much older demographic, and through that mechanism created a sort of new kind of relationship. Is that so, or is it more of the same?
From traveling across the country and meeting with student groups and meeting with college Republican chapters, and honestly, from the two campaigns I saw that had the most presence on college campuses were the Ron Paul campaign and Barack Obama. And a lot, and believe it or not, there was a lot of competition between the two. And there was even a lot of students who were in the Obama group were also in the Ron Paul group and vice versa. Mike Huckabee, I didn't see so much out there. I think they really kind of tapped into the Christian communities and maybe the churches. Young people involvement, from what I saw and even from the numbers of their Facebook groups and some of the, you know, more youth-generated organizations, I didn't see a large youth movement under the Huckabee campaign, and I could be wrong about that, but that was just my observation.
Any data from the huge amounts of numbers you have, Ari?
It's not borne out in the actual turnout. I mean, one of the things we've seen is this incredible fissure on the Democratic side in young voters going for Obama and older voters going for Clinton. We have not seen that kind of breakdown. There are definitely states where Huckabee did very well and did well among younger voters, but it was fairly uniform. And in states where he didn't do as well, we didn't see a fissure there. So at a minimum, you could say that that was limited to sort of activist involvement, if there was that youth enthusiasm. But there was not a notable upsurge in youth support for him over other candidates in the Republican field.
Hello, my name is Jeremy Daw. My question, I suppose, is mostly for Jeff, because I have an intuition that while the internet is a very powerful phenomenon, still the most powerful kind of networks that exist today are the social networks here on Earth, not in cyberspace. And so with all the changes going on in the internet, do you see the same kind of players still being very important on the ground? How has that human face-to-face network dynamic changed in a vague way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in terms of, you know, people-to-people networks and networks we see and interact with, for instance, like the local Republican Party or anything like that, I think a lot of people are bringing a lot of new people into the movement and a lot of people who maybe shared the same ideas but were never networked together on a personal level. And I think that some of these meetup groups or Facebook has allowed them to meet and become active on a local level, whether it's in the party or it's some community activity or local government activity. And I think that's what this campaign has allowed, is to create that cohesiveness between the grassroots, allow people to introduce themselves to one another on the internet and then meet up and actually see each other face to face. But like I said, we started from ground zero a little bit over a year ago when there were a lot of people who might have shared the same ideas but never really were really connected. And I think the internet allowed us to do that through Meetup and through Facebook and the rest.
So before I just may ask you a question, which is, this actually brings up the question of whether or not this is an internet story particularly, right? I mean, on some level, one could make the argument that what you guys did was create a great music video, right? That could have been MTV, right? It could have been something that had nothing to do with the internet. How much is this changed by the kind of ubiquity of the network or the technologies we're talking about here?
I mean, I think the thing is it could have been a music video. I think at the end of the day, the real story is that people want to see something change, and the thing is that they want to see change in the country, and whatever medium they saw it, that was just the thing that gave rise to it and spoke to things that people were speaking about subconsciously, and so it kind of embodied that and help push it along a little bit. But I think at the end of the day, people just want to see a new thing, and he represents that. You know.
Sorry.
I think it's an important question about social networks. I would distinguish, though, the definition of some of them existing only in cyberspace. That's true for some networks, obviously. MoveOn.org, for example, is very effective. But it is largely an online petition with activism offshoots and some very limited cabin interaction, and then occasional meetups or town halls, and that's the whole thing, a virtual network, as to use your words, extant in cyberspace only. But Facebook, of course, is not that, right? You know, Chris Hughes, who went to Harvard and founded Facebook, had a very different concept, a social graph modeling real people in the real world, and to the point that they even have verification requirements, which some people said were going to be too onerous for it to grow. That clearly wasn't the case. You have to have a real email and a real name and a real photo and be a real person. That's very different from MoveOn. It's different from MySpace, where you can do a lot more role-playing. And so I think when you get people on a social network on Facebook, it is very much their real life. And for political and civic action, it's very potent. You know, along a couple decades back, you know, after the Vietnam upheaval and the 68 convention, party leaders made this decision that we were going to change the primary process and started in Iowa and started with caucuses, you know, and there's a rich history there about aspects of that that were, you know, fairly obtuse or coincidental, not thinking through all of the ramifications. One ramification is the caucus is a social process. It's public voting. It's not secret. And you're supposed to bring along people, and the campaigns that are better networked and that have folks who not only know people in the community but are popular in the community do better. In the case of the Iowa caucus, which is, you know, what kicks it all off, people get up in the front of the room and give speeches, and they look out over the room to see who they know. And there are traditional networks that are going to bind those people through church groups and activities and social events, but there are also going to be you know, web-based networks that are not only extant in cyberspace, but that are overlaid on that and that are going to strengthen that. And so if you're doing caucus work or you're doing public protests, or you're doing the kind of political activity that really involves the public domain, not private voting or private donating, then, yeah, you're going to need offline networks more and more and more in this environment.
That's great. Please.
Talking about electability, today Obama said that there are 57 states in the United States. And talking about sound bites, when you choose to follow a candidate who energizes you by the speech, otherwise words, instead of his actions and looking at his voting records and so forth, aren't we encouraging youth and a youth, in fact, going for sound bites in a very superficial choice?
I would agree, but that's why I'm an Obama supporter.
You know, I disagree with that. I don't think that, you know, if you John F. Kennedy was not a, you know, didn't have a huge track record before he was elected president. It's like, you know, at some point you have to, you know, you have to choose a person and believe in them.
And now he's got a school named after him.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, look, we you know, it's not necessarily, you know, it's, you know, it's like Abraham Lincoln wasn't a well-known congressman with a long track record in history before he was elected president. You know, I don't know the exact comment you're referring to, so I can't, you know, address that. But in the case of Obama, you know, it's like you have to believe in hope, or you know, you select who you're going to select. But I don't know that it's you know, he said a lot of other things besides the soundbite. You know, you can listen to the speeches.
So, Wes, what do you think?
I would disagree as well, and I think, I mean, if we think about the presidency, in many ways, you know, it's a pulpit for effecting change through persuading, through eloquence,
through rhetoric, through
rhetoric.
Right?
Yes, you know, I'm not a constitutional scholar. You know, I don't want to get into that. But in many ways, it's the presidency is a bully pulpit, and it's the president who can lead by their words. Can affect a lot. They can influence a lot, and I think that Senator Obama is an incredibly eloquent speaker, and he's touched something in many people through his words, just as Abraham Lincoln did.
So Ari, then we'll go to Dr. Nash over here.
Let me try to agree with part of what you may be getting at. If we are headed towards a larger emphasis on video, which focuses on how we say things and what we look like when we say things and not always the things that we are saying, that is problematic for democracy. And I think we can probably agree on that regardless of which candidate we're speaking about, and also agree that in theory that means that we're going to give yet another advantage to the beautiful people who do well enough as it is. Why do the beautiful people need another platform?
You're doing okay, Ari.
So I think that is a very important point. And if Michael Hirshhorn, who's a VH1 executive that does great web writing for The Atlantic, talks about how we're headed towards Web 3.0, and it's going to be some kind of mix of interactive video, and it's going to look something like your TV set, but cooler. Well, that, you know, that really bums me out, because that would mean that, what, this was a little interlude, like a text-based interlude, a read-write interlude, and then we're going to go back into some sort of, you know, television meltdown. That's problematic for democracy, I would agree.
All right, let's stave that off.
But specific to the soundbite point, this is the flip side where I do strongly disagree with the premise of the question. What we are seeing on YouTube and in a lot of the political activity thus far is not a soundbite culture, in contrast to broadcast media. There are 25-minute speeches on YouTube that get millions of views that only count for a view when you finish the video. So we see a lot of people, and especially young people, watching much farther along than sound bites.
Great. One of our great friends, Victoria Nash from Oxford Internet Institute.
Hi, John. Welcome back. It's lovely to be here.
Will you take us out of our U.S. frame for a moment?
Well,
I was hoping for some international kind of
that's
color
what I was
here.
Hoping to do.
Excellent.
And in a way, it follows on quite nicely from what Ari was just saying, because, you know, we come from a country where our political series is Yes Minister rather than the West Wing, and we don't have many beautiful people in politics. So, you know, my question here really is, how much is this a story about the internet? How much is this a story about American exceptionalism? And looking to the future, Do you think there are any lessons that we could pass on to politicians in the UK, in Europe, in other countries, hoping to engage younger voters, perhaps using internet, perhaps using not?
So you accept the premise that we're doing okay on youth voting and things are going in the right direction?
I'm reasonably convinced. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I think
all
it's
right.
quite an inspiring story you're telling here this evening. So can we do it elsewhere?
Personally, I think the thing is whoever's elected has to be held. You know, it's not about the soundbite this or that. It's about holding them to, you know, he's given these speeches. I believe the speeches. I think he's an incredibly eloquent speaker, you know, makes incredibly eloquent speeches. Didn't like any of the Reverend Wright stuff, thought that was a really hateful guy and wasn't great. The thing to me is that if he does get elected, I want him to do the things he said he was going to do. And that's entirely how I'll judge his presidency, is if he actually acts on the things. If we leave the war, if the government gets smaller, you know, if this becomes a better place, it's winning the election's just the beginning. He really has to do the things he's talking about. Otherwise, personally, I'll feel like it was really, you know, it'll just be a really bad feeling, you know. And with McCain, for me, you know, he was tortured and he supports torture. And I don't think it's going to be easy if it does become between Obama and McCain. I think McCain's going to be very difficult to beat because I think people really like him. But the fact that he wants to stay in the war for 10,000 years is just kind of a non-starter for me.
Anything you want to export, though, from our story to the UK?
You know, I think it's the same. I think it's the same. I think the UK is the same as here. It's like, you know, you hold them to the same responsibilities. It's the same, you know, for me as an outsider, it's like, you know, elect your leaders and then make sure they do what they say they're going to do as much as you can, you know.
What do you think, Jeff?
I would agree. I think technology is politically neutral, just like it probably is country neutral. I think you could probably use the same tools and the same activities you do here in America overseas. So no, I don't see that you need to create some sort of new system or new thing that, and maybe there might be some unique characteristics that are only applied to in the UK or anywhere else, but I think the technology is neutral and how it's used is neutral, and you can use it in wherever you are or whatever political ideology you hold. It's more of a vehicle than it is any sort of attached to any country or ideology.
Yeah, it's a more efficient way to reach people. That's what the internet provides, and I imagine people in England are using it exactly the same way, you know?
All right, what do you think?
I mean, I don't know that we're in the business of exporting much right now in the way of our, you know, political principles. I don't know enough. I know that there's some members of Parliament that are doing the YouTubing on a regular basis. Is that right? I mean, do you want to give us 30 seconds of what y'all are doing or that you're aware of?
Absolutely. Enlighten us with the British experience.
How little I know, actually. I mean, I think in the UK, the focus has been much more on representation and communication with your elected representatives, and much less on this sort of mass campaigning. I mean, I find it very hard to imagine the Labour Party or the Conservative Party running the sorts of viral campaigns so successfully as been done here. Just as I find it equally hard to imagine us doing an equivalent of Obama Girl with any of our major political candidates in the UK. It's a terrifying thought.
They're just not as sexy, Victoria.
So, thank you. I suppose that's why I'm asking the question. I mean, I completely take the point that technology is neutral and that these tools are neutral, but they work more effectively in different systems and they work more effectively with different types of people, perhaps, types of message. And
necessity will make them use these tools. Necessity, at some point, they will need to be, there'll be a candidate who's behind who will need to reach more people, and then they'll use these tools, because it's ultimately the fact that it's such low cost and there's no cost to actually getting the message out makes it an effective tool for any politician to use it to keep trying to reach their constituency. If they have the choice between spending money and not spending money,
somebody's going to figure out other people are going to have to respond. Then they'll call up Jeff and figure it out what they did.
The message, again, like I said to begin with, I think with Barack Obama or Ron Paul, you had an inspirational message that people resonated with and people wanted to work for and people wanted to donate towards, and where maybe you don't have that over in the UK currently. Like you said, you couldn't find an Obama girl with either the Labour Party or the Conservative Party over there, but maybe there will become that shining face that has the charisma and the character that will excel on the web. And like for here, Rudy Giuliani, who was the original front runner, I don't think he really resonated, especially with the youth. Of where I went, I never really met a single person that was a Giuliani supporter or had a Giuliani yard sign in their front yard. And I think the message is strong in their character and the personality.
So I want to get a couple more questions in. Our friend from FOHO,
sure.
Tell us who you are.
I'm Kenzie Bach. I'm a freshman from the college. My question is, I guess it's most directly related to your experience, Jeff, but it seems like there's this trouble where you're uniting a whole disparate group of people who are across 50 states and wouldn't otherwise have a platform to unite. But their only common cause that they can make is every 4 years for a presidential race. Because other than that, we don't have plebiscites, we don't have any sort of national campaign besides that. So I guess my question is, I know that you, Ari, were involved, I think, in the Lamont anti-Lieberman campaign, and that like is the way of the future, that like these big national constituencies will focus on like specific like statewide things, even if they're not like from Connecticut or something like that, just because, you know, it's there and it's a cause. Like, what do you do? I know that you're looking at what you do with this energy, but when you have a national base that can exist virtually, can't exist geographically, what do you do in our political system with that?
I don't want to give away too many secrets in terms of what our plans are and what we're talking about.
We want as many as we're willing to give on camera.
But I guess I can already tell what's been public. I mean, I think the assets the campaign has is a very valuable donor list. They have an email list of over 400,000 people that would, if Dr. Paul said jump, 10,000 people would jump, or 100,000 people would jump. So there is something there that kind of has Dr. Paul is currently the leader of, and waiting for direction and waiting for some sort of movement going forward. And I think you're right in terms of localizing politics. There is no national figure currently outside of Dr. Paul. And every 4 years, you may only get a president. But it is time to turn it local. And it is time to look and identify what state races or what city council races or what congressional races can we, and when I say we, our message, a constitutional message, back to the original intent of the Republican Party, those principles, where can we win and where can we affect change in that sense? And so you're right, and that's what I guess kind of lays burden on Dr. Paul and the campaign, and not just that, but the grassroots and everyone else, is what kind of rises to the top, what kind of organizations come to the top and can direct change in real sense in terms of what we're looking for change. And I think it's going to be local. I think you're going to have to focus on local politics.
Great question.
You know, pick good fights with deadlines and vilifiable opponents and clear objectives. Now that all sounds like maybe corporate speak, but you should drill that down to the example. Climate change is hard to organize for, even if you have Al Gore out there, you know, making cool movies and a big budget. Having a deadline to get the responsible media like New York Times or Washington Post to stop quoting, you know, corporate sponsored liars about the climate change issue with a grassroots campaign is something you can get your head around. And you say they were quoted 7 times last year, and this person is just paid by Chevron to make things up, and we are going to get the truth out about them. In a responsible way with these deadlines and these metrics, so that they're quoted as, comma, this person said this, comma, and they're paid by the oil industry.
Okay. You guys, we need to get somewhat back to youth and technology and so forth. Jesse in brief, and then Charles Nesson.
The one thing I would say about that is that
I love climate change, but
people
just
only respond to stories. Like, in the end, it all has to be about something that people can hold on to. Nobody per se connects to climate change or youth or these things. It becomes about, like, the reason the Obama thing is effective is because he laid out a story in his speech, and then I took his speech and dramatized it, but it started with an underlying idea. So it's like, if the campaign's going to go on, Ron Paul's going to have to come up with a new story about why people should continue to participate, and it's going to have to start over at ground zero, because if you send out an email to 400,000 people and it's just, we want to continue, there's no vision in that. It has to be laid out as a vision. If not that, then nobody will respond.
Professor Nesson, then we'll go to John Kelly.
Hi, Charles Nesson. I had the pleasure of appearing on Colbert to talk about poker, and actually proposed to him the possibility of a presidential poker game as a way of really seeing the character of the participants in a face-to-face fashion. And I was just, you have so much knowledge about how this goes. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how I might further that enterprise, or?
All roads lead back to poker in some cases.
I mean, like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Like, how would you get them to play poker? I'm missing it. What do you?
I can ask Dr. Paul, but I don't know if he's a good poker player.
Yeah.
I think Stephen Colbert would probably actually win that poker match.
Charlie, I think you need to tell us more about your idea and why you think this is a good one, and I think you'll get more out of Jesse Dillon that way.
Yeah. You mean to ask Obama if he would play poker?
Well, all right. Let's just take what you said, which I resonate with it so much, even though I'm not a political person. I'm into this space as a rhetorical storytelling space. Right. And the connection between real and virtual in storytelling is quite remarkable. In a sense, you program something and then it's real. It's almost like you tell it virtually and then you tell it real.
Yeah.
So, for example, I look at the Democratic Party right now, and it seems to me that it's got a problem. Obama needs to show that he is capable of reaching out and bridging difference. And the biggest difference, obviously, is still with Hillary.
Sure.
And I see her laboring to let the process conclude, let every person have a vote. She's going to fight it to the end.
Right.
But somehow there needs to be a reconciliation story.
Well, I agree with you 100% and have actually declined working on... I'm not part of the campaign. I'm outside the campaign. I don't talk with Obama. I don't really know... And have been given many opportunities to talk to him, but my feeling is that I'm not a political person. I did this for the reasons that I did it. I don't want to be a part of that, which is one of the things about holding him responsibly to what he says he's going to do. The thing is that I actually think the tenor of the conversation has been very poor up to now, and they haven't, and the issue is if they don't actually reconcile the parties, then they won't win, because I think that McCain is going to be a very formidable opponent. And I think that I think for me as an outside observer, I look at them, and it's a strange analogy, but it's like, you know, if I look at Hillary, she's more like Chagall. She paints the same picture every single day. And if I look at him, he's more like Picasso. He's painting a different picture every day. And I'd like to see it all come together as something over time. And I really don't know whether it will. I don't have any crystal ball that says that it'll be a... and, you know, if it does come together, I'd like to work on it at that point. You know, again, as an outsider. But I don't know whether he'll solve it. And I haven't seen him make all the steps up to now, which I've entirely agreed with. I don't think he handled the last few. I don't think he's been a great front runner, and I don't think he's handled himself particularly well in recent days. You know, Wes would disagree with me on this, but yeah.
I know it's a bridge between poker and the reconciliation story, but yeah. I don't want to monopolize this crowd.
Hardly. Do you have the mic?
Oh dear.
It's founder prerogative, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've actually made a little YouTube movie, which I would love to see go viral. It's the story of a poker game. It actually began when I was moderating a panel at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which I was part of, on the 1968 Voting Rights Act, celebrating the life of and work of John Doerr, who was a great civil rights leader. And Deval Patrick was the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in 1992, 93, I think, and spoke at this. And he was at the podium, and he made a lovely speech. And as he was leaving, I was sitting right next. I called him over and said, "Deval, do you play poker?" And he said, "Yeah, not very well." And I said, "We got to talk," right? And this is caught on a very nice little piece of video. I then had the opportunity to go, as I say, on Colbert and propose the idea of a presidential poker game. But of course, the actual problem of convening it is quite substantial if you take it as a real challenge. But if you take it as a virtual challenge, it turns out to be quite easy. And so I've made a video of a poker game. It's unfolding. It opens with Deval Patrick pushing out his chips behind a proposal to build three massive casinos in Massachusetts. and getting called by the Massachusetts Speaker of the House, Sal DeMasi, longtime leader of the Democratic Party, ally of Hillary. This was a real controversy in Massachusetts. I don't know how many of you followed it, but basically, DeMasi, the Lord of the House, beat Patrick Cole in the showdown, just absolutely decimated him. Well, the action now moves to DeMasi, and he opens with a proposition to legalize poker in Massachusetts. He's got an idea that poker could really be a winner, and as a game of skill, it suits more than the slots, the Massachusetts image. The action moves to Hillary. She's in a tricky position. She says the polls tell her that people want the slots. They want the big casinos. She calls. Now the action moves to Obama. And what's Obama going to do? Well, it's interesting where the story can go. This is, to me, a very interesting question, the question of the hypocrisy of the American policy towards gambling. It's a huge issue, utterly ignored in the campaign. It's too dangerous. And yet it's real. And if someone like Obama is going to actually show that he can change, it's an opportunity for him to demonstrate a changed way of thinking and an opportunity to play out a story in a way that it's possible for Hillary to lose and yet to be reconciled. And so it's a project in process. I'm debuting the video tomorrow morning.
We'll see if it has Yes, We Can virality to it, Charlie, tomorrow morning.
All right. But in its way, it's playing with this idea of a story with public figures. You're free to use them as characters. They're extraordinarily powerful characters.
And will he make the right choice, or will he make the choice to be safe?
Yeah,
I mean, it's definitely an interesting question.
Thank you.
Hard act to follow, but we'll do three more questions. John Kelly, Morningside Analytics, our good friend, and then we'll go up around here.
Well, thinking about that creative idea has probably loosened the logic of my question a little bit, so I apologize. But I think it's probably safe to say that when a politician stands on a stage talking about how outraged the people are about the right controversy or whatever the controversy is at the time, the people are not actually outraged at that moment. What the politician hopes is that by the end of the week, they will be outraged. It's just one example, like all these kind of manufactured controversies, of how, in the traditional media landscape, the way things have been, elites more or less manufacture opinions somehow. You know, it's a kind of closed process. And it seems that what we see in this election is that if public opinion is sausage, that the walls of the sausage factory are getting a little more transparent, and we're able to kind of see how a lot of these techniques that have been evolved for mass media aren't working so well, because now there are other inputs into agenda setting, other voices that are part of the mix. But I'm curious what you folks think about whether, to what extent is it that if opinion is no longer a thing to be manufactured, in a sense, by competing elites, and instead the process is opening up, the voices of people are being heard through online media. Are we heading in a more democratic tradition where there is something, kind of generative public opinion that is not something to be gamed for real? Or is it just that the rules of gaming it are going to change and smart people will come along and figure out how to manipulate the internet and the what appears to be viral stuff the same way that they do with the mainstream media?
I'm getting the eye from the organizers of the forum, so I can just ask each of you just to state your question, if that's okay, and then we'll take reactions to each of these questions in turn. So if you wouldn't mind and keep it brief, that'd be great.
Yes, I was just wondering if this uptick in youth involvement is due only to, or mostly to, educated middle and upper middle class young people getting more involved, or if it is involving the enfranchisement of low-income and sort of underprivileged people as well.
Great, great question.
Yeah, my name is Brett, and I came from Seattle today. So just want to ask you, when I work with student groups and tell them about new online organizing tools, they get it. They're like, yeah, this will help my normal efforts and what I'm doing in the real space and be more effective. But when I work with groups like the Sierra Club, or I mean, even some of the questioners here today, there's obviously this mindset that anything you do in a cyberspace or online must replace real-world connections, real-world conversations. And I think young people get that it has to mirror and facilitate one for the other. And that really troubles me that that it seems like the more that more innovation that happens, the more the differences and the generational divide is pronounced. Mm. And is that just going to continue to be expanding, or is there, you know, is that just going to, are we just going to have older 50, 60, 70-year-old people not missing out on this ability to really interconnect in this way?
So. Great. Peter Emerson, will you give us the last question, then I'll let each of you have a last word.
The question is, that's been alluded to slightly here, is that a large part of the story, it seems to me, and I'd like your input, is the media and the transformation of the internet from having just bled partly into the mainstream media network and cable into becoming actually a source of a lot of the information and the reporting. We just had Joe Scarborough up here. The question was asked, which confirmed my other conversations, what do you read in the morning to prepare for your cable news program? And he first said, not the New York Times, not the Washington Post. The first was the Drudge Report, second was Huffington Post, and then it was Politico, .com and RealPolitik. So I'm asking, don't you think that's a large piece of this story, particularly as it relates to young people?
So I think since we've invoked Politico, we should start with the gentleman from Politico and then go down and end with Jesse Doan. And if we can take any number of those questions in your final remarks, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, I do think, yes, you see a supplanting of certain aspects of political media. And this works very well for politics and democracy because people's views matter even when they're wrong, even when they're mistaken. I don't think we're going to see the same full-scale kind of revolution in, say, you know, online science magazines, because people in the comment section saying things that are just directly wrong are less relevant. Whereas if a high portion of the population incorrectly misunderstands what a candidate's religion is, which is a dynamic we have in play, that's going to be a political issue even based on falsehood. So yes, I think that's part of it. To the question about turnout, no, I think the most troubling aspect of the surge in youth turnout now, which is just like, by the way, the Vietnam era, is that when you get down into poorer folks who have no college education whatsoever, the data is typically divided to include any kind of community college or anything local, even for a year. So basically folks who have none of that, who either went only through high school or less, you just don't see the upsurge. So even in the high point of 72, college-educated youth were turning out at 70%, but non-college were 37%. And in 04, when we saw the boost, it was up to 59% for college-educated youth and up, but only to 34% for non-college-educated youth. So even when there is a huge war or a huge amount of interest going that drives turnout, the concomitant boost among less educated people is very minor. And I think quickly, I would say, presidential campaigns and large-scale turnout operations simply are not incentivized to spend money to turn out that demographic because the returns from their perspective for zero-sum politics are very narrow.
Wes Hill, last words.
I defer. I don't have any comments.
You're a good man. Yeah, people get to their drinks sooner,
yeah.
Right?
Well, then I'll be rapid fires as well. To the last question, yeah, I agree. Go around and ask anybody. I think that was an email I sent asking everybody how do they utilize the internet on a daily basis. And it's right. I get on and I read antiwar.com and Lou Rockwell's blog and Drudge Report and the rest and get onto those websites. And I don't turn on the TV in the morning. And I think more and more you're seeing that. So it's leveling the playing field. To the question about the disconnect between the older generation and the younger generation, I couldn't agree more. I have that frustration every day trying to articulate that to donors for one of my future projects as well. And if someone has a solution for that, I'm more than willing to listen. Young people, I think he answered it with underprivileged individuals. I think that's the correct answer. And then your last question, I'm sorry, I don't want to leave you out because you had the first one. The question you had.
Just to what extent
Oh, right, right, right.
Kind of the democratization of more of our country. Yeah. No, I agree. It lowers the playing field, lowers barriers to entry, and people like these guys can create a video and go viral and be enormous. Whereas in the past, you may have had to sign a record deal and yeah. go through a producer or someone. So it definitely breaks down that bottleneck and those barriers to entry. And if you have a good idea, it's gonna succeed. And I think that's what kind of the free market's all about. And so it's good to see that while working on the internet.
I think that the median age is getting younger and younger. You know, my 8-year-old is old on the internet now. Kids that come over are 5 are using different sites than she uses. And it's like age just gets younger. And I think the thing is that you can really be an outsider now and have your view heard. And I think that'll just happen more and more. I think that's the great part about it.
Well, you guys are quite wonderful. Please join me in thanking the panel, a bunch of outsiders whose voices have been heard. Thank you. Tell me, what do I say? And you're all welcome to a reception on the 5th floor immediately after this for a drink, so please join us. Thank you. Very well done. Thanks for all the data.